Hello, and welcome to Ed Infinitum, the podcast that makes school the subject of study. I'm your host, David Nuremberg. This is episode number 6. Is school supposed to assess students or grade them? And that is the question for this episode. But there's another question we need to address first. Is the purpose of all those tests and quizzes and projects and presentations that you do in school to measure your learning or to rank it? When education scholars use the word assessment, it's not just a jargony, ed-speaky way to talk about grading, although sometimes it is, but it's really not the same thing. And the confusion and conflation of those two things, assessment and grading, has really led to some serious problems in the way our formal systems of education work. So, assessment is basically any means by which a teacher, or for that matter, a student or parent or really anyone, can attempt to determine what a student knows and can do. So those quizzes and tests and essays and presentations and projects are designed to do just that, and not just at the end of the term either. One way in which educators classify assessments is in three separate categories: diagnostic, formative, and summative. And I'll try to explain these through the analogy of a blind date. Now, depending on what stage you feel you're at in life, maybe this will hit a little too close to home, or maybe you'll be exhaling sighs of relief that you no longer have to endure this kind of thing. But let's say that you've been set up on a blind date with a friend of a friend. These days, what's the very first thing you're likely to do? Check them out on social media, of course. That's what we call a diagnostic assessment. It's a check to see what conditions are like before any new interactions begin. In a classroom, diagnostic assessments help teachers identify their students' current knowledge of a subject, their current level of skill and capability, and to clarify what misconceptions they might have before teaching takes place. Knowing where their students are at helps a teacher to better plan what to teach and how to teach it. Some common types of diagnostic assessments include pretests, usually not for a grade, low or no stakes, or maybe self-assessments, when students orally or in writing identify their own skills and competencies. It might take the form of interviews, brief private chats with students, or letters that students write to their teacher before the start of the term. Diagnostic assessments, in short, are an attempt to get a sense of what you're dealing with. So let's say that your blind date passes the Facebook test and now you're having dinner with them. How can you determine if your date's going well? You can evaluate your own sense of comfort and engagement. You could observe if your date is making eye contact or if they've been checking their phone constantly or leaving the table to use the bathroom. You can see if they accurately remember and reference things you've told them. Gathering this sort of data is called formative assessment, a check midway in progress to see how well things are going. And if things aren't going as well as you'd like, you still have the chance to turn things around for the better, perhaps by pulling out your best dance moves or that tried and true story of the time you met Beyonce. Hey, it could work. In a classroom, formative assessment provides feedback and information during the instructional process while learning is still taking place. It's a teacher's spot check, not only to check on students' progress, but also to assess their own progress as an instructor. If after 3 days of lessons about long division, 90% of the students fail the quiz, maybe the teacher needs to try again with a new approach. All sorts of things can be used as formative assessments in a classroom. Observations, nonverbal feedback, homework exercises, reflection journals, questions and answer sessions, conferences, in-class activities, feedback surveys, and, yes, quizzes and tests, assuming that the students have a chance to make a comeback through some sort of revision or retake that demonstrates that, all right, this time, I've got it. Let's head back to that blind date. Once it's over, how do you know if it was successful or not? Well, if one of you calls the other to suggest another date and you both think that's a great idea, I'd call that a success. I would also call that summative assessment. At the end of an instructional experience, are students ready to move on to the next phase? Summative assessment takes place after learning has been completed and provides information and feedback that sums up the teaching and learning process. Typically, no formal learning is taking place at this stage other than incidental learning, which might take place with the completion of projects and assignments. Rubrics, often developed around a set of standards or expectations, are often used for summative assessment. A really good practice is for teachers to give students rubrics before they even begin working on that summative project so the students know what's expected of them. And as for those summative projects, these can be traditional exams, term papers, portfolios, performances, any sort of major wrap-it-all-up-at-the-end sort of assessment. Summative assessments are what we call assessment of learning, an attempt to see how much learning has taken place and of what kind. Educators call this assessment of learning, but we're also aware that assessment can be used for learning as well. Remember all of those formative assessments, those spot checks along the way? Both teachers and students can use those assessments and the evidence from them to adjust what they're currently doing. Teachers use it to go back and maybe change their instructional procedures, and students can use it to adjust their current learning strategies. Of course, for this to really happen, teachers need to provide constructive and detailed feedback in a timely way that makes sense to the students. The function of that feedback should be to help students make adjustments that will improve their achievement getting towards those goals. And when they do use that feedback to improve, their efforts should be rewarded with increased scores or grades. Too often, teachers and students alike can get trapped into thinking that all assessments are summative. They're all high stakes, here's your one chance to show you've learned something, and if you haven't, oh well, we're moving on to the next unit. It does give a nice little collection of grades in a gradebook for a teacher to tabulate at the end of the quarter. But really, summative assessment is of most use for long-term planning for teachers, their supervisors, state evaluators. In other words, they're assessments of learning intended to help adult decision makers, and really not much use to students, except insofar as students can use them to determine whether to brag about their report card or hide it from their parents. But assessments are not just for use by teachers and policymakers. Too often we think of a student's relationship with an assessment in the terms of us as teachers assessing their learning. But remember, students can also use assessments as a means of learning. Not only, as we talked about earlier, for them to keep track of their own progress and adjust their learning strategies if necessary to compensate, the very act of self-assessment can be a kind of learning. Educators call this metacognition, knowledge of one's own thought processes and developments. Assessment as learning comes from the idea that learning is not just a matter of transferring ideas from someone who's knowledgeable to someone who isn't, but rather is an active process of cognitive restructuring and growth that occurs when individuals interact with new ideas. Within this view of learning, students must make critical connections between assessments and learning if they're to truly advance as learners. In its simplest form, think of personality tests. The idea is for you to better understand something about yourself. Say, which Friends character you're most like, in a way that will presumably influence your behavior from now on. Like, maybe it's time to be more of a Chandler and less of a Joey. For students to be actively engaged in creating their own understanding, they need to become adept at personally monitoring what they're learning. In understanding the ways in which they think and how they learn best, their knowledge of personal skills and abilities and challenges, and learning strategies and when and how to use them, the ability to change strategies when one doesn't work, setting goals and using relevant background knowledge, monitoring, self-testing, and regulating the processes of learning and appraising the products that you create. As you can imagine, students need to be taught how to do this. The teacher has a role in promoting independent learning through the use of assessment as learning. They can model and teach those skills and guide students in setting goals and monitoring their progress. They can provide exemplars and models of good practice and quality work, and then work with the students to develop clear criteria for what that good practice looks like. They can guide students in developing internal feedback and self-monitoring and provide regular opportunities to practice so students can become more confident and competent. They also need to help create an environment where it's safe for students to take chances and where they're ready to jump in with support if the students fall short. So that, in about an 8-minute nutshell, is assessment. Now, while the purpose of assessment is measurement, the purpose of grading is ranking, determining which students performed better or worse vis-a-vis their fellows. This is most obvious when teachers grade based on a curve. The grade a student receives is in many ways determined by the grade that other students receive. If a teacher plots the test scores of her class and sees that the average student answered 60 out of 100 questions correctly, and no one got more than 80 questions correct, then she could use the curve to adjust the scoring so that a score of 80 earns an A. The rationale behind grading on a curve is all about ranking, not assessment. If 90% of the students in a class earn an A on a test, from an assessment point of view, that means, assuming the test is a valid measurement of their knowledge, that they achieve the learning goals of the lesson, or unit, or whatever. It's a victory for all involved, students and teacher alike. This is the goal of public education, especially in the wake of the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001, to ensure that each and every student meets each and every learning goal. But simultaneous and entirely contradictory to this mission is the fear among teachers that if 90% of the class earns an A, then somehow the test must have been too easy. the very same evidence of both the teacher's and her class's incredible success from an assessment point of view becomes an alert from a grading point of view that she's done something wrong. She'll conclude, might even hear from her colleagues or supervisors, that she's made expectations too low or too easy. Because in grading, even on a non-curve test, there is an expectation from God knows where that the ideal outcome is a bell curve. Most students earning middling grades with a few excelling and a few flunking on either end. You can see how this can lead to problems. It makes schooling into a train with a locomotive placed on each end, each pulling in an opposite direction. Some teachers will make the argument that grades, assuming they're not curved, really are the same thing as assessment. After all, in a 10-question quiz, if you get 6 right, then it's an assessment that you understand 60% of the material, an assessment as well as a grade. This presupposes some assumptions about the test. Number one, that answering its questions is a valid means of assessing students' command of material. As we discussed in episode 4, it's very possible for a student to answer objective response questions correctly, yet not understand the concepts behind those questions. If I memorize the fact that all regenozoids have gibberworts on their tail fins, and I get a question on a test that asks, where are the gibberworts in a regenozoid? I could answer, on their tail fins, and get the question right, without ever understanding just what regenozoids or gibberworts even are. One of the best ways to test a student's command of concepts is to ask her to apply those concepts to a new scenario, say using the rate times time equals distance formula to solve a problem about how long it will take your train to cross 200 miles if it's going 120 miles an hour. And as long as there's only one answer, in this case about 1.7 hours, then you can be confident she knows the answer and that she's not likely to be late the next time she embarks on train travel. So far, so good. But for more complex concepts, not every application of a skill or set of knowledge will have a single definite answer, or even 5 possible correct answers. Think about historical analysis. What was the most important factor that led to the French Revolution? Depending on the evidence you use and the arguments you make, you could have any number of valid answers. Depletion of the royal coffers, years and years of poor harvests, heavy taxes by the ruling regime, inspiration from the American Revolution a few years earlier. Some answers are clearly better than others. If you say Marie Antoinette's choice to wear a blue dress versus a red dress, that's really not going to cut it. But with this question, you're assessing a lot of things simultaneously. Not only students' knowledge of and understanding of historical events, but also their skills in analysis and judgment, as well as in the use of evidence to back up their arguments and their skill at written persuasion and argumentation. That's a lot of moving parts that in many ways depend upon each other. It's really hard to separate them out into categories sometimes. And when you do, the moment you give one of those categories more weight than another, you're no longer just assessing. You're making a value judgment for the purposes of ranking. When you take points off for misunderstandings, you're also making a judgment. How many points off does this type of misunderstanding versus that type of misunderstanding merit? Lest you think this is just a problem with those crunchy, touchy-feely humanities classes, what about a science or engineering class where students need to demonstrate their understanding of the principles they learn by designing some answer to a challenge? Say, building a hypothetical, more energy-efficient high school building, or designing and writing code to make an app that helps connect struggling students with tutors. There are all sorts of ways you could satisfy the requirements of those assignments, some of which might demonstrate knowledge of the underlying concepts in very different ways. At some point, a human teacher has to weigh in and make at least some kinds of subjective judgments. Now, in principle, I suppose a teacher could construct the perfect 7-page, 12-column rubric for keeping track of all the various factors and possibilities and how they all interrelate with each other, in a way that perfectly balances their relative merit. But couldn't another teacher design an equally effective rubric privileging other things, making different calls about the relative value of one skill or aspect versus another? Even if you hold all the component skills and parts to be equally valuable, that too is a value judgment, saying that spelling and grammar matter as much as argumentation and thesis. And even if somehow all teachers in the school agreed on the relative values of different aspects of an assignment, would every teacher agree on all the gradations that separate partially demonstrates knowledge from fully demonstrates knowledge? That kind of uniformity has never appeared in any school I've ever seen or read about. The way that standardized tests try to get around this challenge of grading complex products is to get multiple people assessing each piece of work and to take a sort of average of their judgments. I'm sure they've done testing for iterator reliability, or at least I hope they have, but still, at some level, the designers of those standardized tests still made these kinds of judgment calls, and the calls that ETS makes for the SATs are different than those that the ACT's designers use. Now, none of this is a problem from an assessment point of view, but it is a problem from a grading point of view. And to understand how and why that is, we have to look under the hood at the kinds of data you get from grades, which also means we have to take a quick look at some of the ways in which we understand data as a concept. In the service of the question, how do we measure what we measure, let's look at several different types of data. One is nominal data. As the name implies, it's about names. You assign a word to a data item. The words have no numerical or proportional relationship. They're just labels. For example, gender. We can use the label male, female, genderqueer, whatever you want. But in terms of data, it really only amounts to words in a box. You can surely count how many people in your classroom identify as male or female or genderqueer or whatever. But the labels themselves have no inherent relationship. You could just as easily call them Smurf and Burf. You're not really talking statistics at this point, you're talking semiotics. Another kind of data is what we call ordinal data. The labels you assign here have a value in that they can be measured in terms of which comes after the other, or which is bigger or smaller than the other. Think about the hospital pain scale. You know, when you're in a hospital room and the doctor asks you to point to this chart where you've got a series of faces, with a smiley face and the words no pain on the far left, and moving slowly to the right until you've got an extremely sad-looking face and the phrase worst possible pain. Now, on some of these charts, the faces and words are also accompanied by numbers. 0 for no pain, 1 to 2 for mild pain, 3 to 4 for moderate pain, and so forth, up till 9 and 10 for worst possible pain. On this kind of scale, an 8 indicates more pain than a 4, but is it precisely twice the amount of pain, as the numbers might suggest? No. Distances between ordinal values are not equal. They're not even known. All we can talk about, really, is their relation to one another. Is one more or less, bigger or smaller, farther or closer than the other? Still another kind of data we work with is called interval data. In interval data, the difference between values is equal and consistent. Think about a thermometer. The distance between 10 degrees and 20 degrees is the same as the distance between 30 degrees and 40 degrees. There is consistency of measurement, not just of relationship. However, this still isn't true measurement in the sense that zero isn't absolute zero, at least not on the Fahrenheit or Celsius scale. It's just another mark on the scale. 0 degrees Celsius, in other words, does not mean there is no temperature whatsoever. It's just sort of a guidepost. Marks on interval data are in that sense arbitrary. You can measure distance between them as true measurement, but you could once again just as easily be measuring the distance between quack and mac, smurf and burf, as between 10 and 0, so long as the distances between all of those values remain equal. When we talk about so-called true measurement, we're usually talking about ratio data. Ratio data is just like interval data, but in ratio data, 0 means absence. Ratio data is often what we use when we're talking about tangible physical things. Think about height, weight, number of objects in a room, etc. 0 means there aren't any. If you have a height of 0 inches, my friend, you do not exist. This is so-called real measurement. So the big question is, out of nominal, ordinal, interval, and ratio data, what kind of data do grades represent? Well, in one sense, we could try and say ratio, because a score of 0 on an assessment is generally taken to indicate that the student has had no learning here, or at least none she's willing or able to share with us. But ratio data by definition also has to be interval data. And does a student who earned an 80% on a test know twice as much as a student who earned a 40? Well, it's interval data in the sense that the first student answered twice as many questions correctly as the second student. But as soon as you move away from simple questions with easy right or wrong, yes or no answers, all you've got really is ordinal data when it comes to applying grades to measure student learning. In other words, a student who's earned an 80 on a paper demonstrates more learning than a student whose paper earns a 40, but we don't really know how much more. Twice as much? Really? And does every other paper that earns a 40 represent precisely half as much learning as every paper that earns an 80? The more we get into complex assessments like essays and lab reports and major projects, the more our grading data starts to look simply ordinal. We can tell which students are demonstrating more learning than others, but we really can't, in any statistically valid sense, determine precisely how much more learning they're demonstrating. So why is this a problem? Well, it's a tremendous problem because of schools' mission to not only assess, but also to rank. A student who earns a 79.5 fails to meet the cutoff for honors, but a student who earns an 80 does. An SAT score of 1250 gets you into this college, but 1249 keeps you out. It's in some way disingenuous for schools to make the claim that they can measure learning with that kind of precision and that kind of reliability, from assessment to assessment, from teacher to teacher, all consistent all the time. That's just not true. But those fine shades between numbers carry real and life-altering weight. So wouldn't any kind of assessment, even if grading isn't in the picture, suffer from this same kind of problem of precision and reliability? Not necessarily. The concept of competency-based assessment has become increasingly popular in education circles. The idea is to determine when a student can demonstrate that they know an item or can perform a skill that an assignment calls for, and when they do, they demonstrate competency. At its simplest, we can determine that the student either can't do something, can do it, or can partially do it. And some diehard competency-based assessment folks will tell you that those three options, can do, can't do, or can partially do, are really all the precision of measurement that any tool can honestly give you. I don't want to get deep into those reads, so for now I'll just describe some of the basic principles of competency-based education. The idea is that students progress through learning objectives as they demonstrate mastery of content at their own pace. It allows them theoretically to show what they know when they know it. In competency-based education, not everyone in class is learning the same thing at the same time. When a student can demonstrate that he can meet a certain competency, he moves on to the next more challenging learning goal, even if the kid sitting next to him is three goals behind that. Our behind student in a competency-based model will have as many opportunities as he needs to go back, make mistakes, analyze and fix those mistakes, get help, practice the skill, and then try again to demonstrate mastery, however long it takes. Students are constantly, therefore, taking formative assessments, the data from which they or their teacher use to determine whether or not they're ready to move on. Frankly, before the advent of technologies that now allow for independent or small group student instruction and assessment to happen asynchronously, I'm not sure this kind of teaching would have been possible except in very small classes. But now, I can launch websites like NoRedInk.com and get a quick view in a moment of all my students' various levels of progress on the grammar exercises they've been practicing, while my math colleague can assign Khan Academy videos to help support her struggling learners so she doesn't have to be everywhere at once. It's quite an age we live in, yet our schools still operate largely based on the factory-line production models of the 19th century. As Sir Kenneth Robinson is fond of saying, we still educate students in age-based batches, as if the most important thing they have in common is their date of manufacture. Thanks to the huge investments in education reform that industrialist Andrew Carnegie made at the dawn of the 20th century, we also use this bizarre system of seat time to determine academic progress. If you're familiar with the idea of courses in high school or even college being worth a certain amount of credit, that comes right from Andrew Carnegie. In fact, they used to be called Carnegie credits, or credit hours, and they are time-based references for measuring educational attainment. In our present system, if you want a diploma from a high school or a college, you don't just take a test to demonstrate your competencies right away. You have to prove that you have spent a certain number of hours sitting in a classroom. So, for example, the Western Association of Schools and Colleges determines a credit or student hour to be 14.4 hours because a Carnegie unit is defined now as 240 minutes per week for 36 weeks, regardless past a certain level of how much you actually learn during that time. See, sure, you have to demonstrate a certain level of competency, but in a credit hour system like the one we have, a D minus counts the same as an A, in terms of the fact that you still earn 3 credits for passing that course. What counts the most past a certain point is literally how many hours you have spent in the classroom. Furthermore, the design of the system is for those hours to be highly scripted, that the school and the teacher determine what you're supposed to be learning, in what order, and how much time you're going to be allowed to demonstrate that you've learned it. And if you don't demonstrate learning by the end of that time, guess what? Ready or not, you just get moved on to the next concept. Then at the end of the year, assuming you've learned some minimal amount, you move on to the next grade because grade placement is determined mostly by your age. If this feels kind of like a conveyor belt, that's no accident. Remember, this was a system designed to prepare Americans for working in factories. Why do you think we have bells that separate class times? They were there to give students a preview of the shift change bells they would hear once they graduated to work on a factory floor. It's a system that, in the end, is really very poorly suited to learning. Some people can succeed because they can keep up with the conveyor belt's timetable, while a whole bunch of other people to varying degrees don't. Competency-based education seeks to provide an alternative that's more in line with how human beings actually learn. I will be the first to tell you, though, as someone who has been attempting to employ competency-based models for the last few years in my own classes, that this is a really difficult thing to do. It's hard to figure out where every student is and what they need at all times. And remember, while you're trying to do that, all the structures of traditional public schooling are set up to thwart it. Arranging and placing students by age or deciding at the outset who's in honors and remedial and then letting them both just hold on to that status all year long, regardless of what skills they actually demonstrate. An evaluation system for both students and teachers that rewards covering as many standards as possible, no matter how cursorily, rather than sacrificing some to explore others in the time and depth that some students require in order to really get and own that knowledge. Pitting students against one another and giving them all kinds of incentives for academic dishonesty, because what matters most is not what they learn, but how quickly they learn it. Malcolm Gladwell's very engaging podcast, Revisionist History, once had an episode that raised the question of why our system privileges hares over tortoises, people who can perform complex tasks quickly versus those that take more time. He uses the metaphor of the popular app game Puzzle Rush versus chess, and argues that an absolute genius champion at one of those games might fare pretty poorly at the other. Yet our system rewards those who come to knowledge quicker as smarter, at least by the definitions of our schools. That's why we have timed tests, after all. But Gladwell argues that this definition of smarter is somewhat arbitrary. If a person can become an excellent doctor if given 10 years to study, while someone else only needs 6 years, why deny ourselves the opportunity to have two excellent doctors and just pick the second one? Do we have a glut of doctors or something and have to turn some away? I don't really think so. Yet I've had more than one of my graduate students raise the caution, if we made all our school assessment competency-based and students didn't graduate until they essentially knew enough to earn A's at everything, then wouldn't that wreak havoc with college admissions and job applications? In other words, how would colleges and employers know how to separate the best from the second best, the wheat from the chaff, as it were? This gets into some pretty fundamental assumptions about capitalism and scarcity and hierarchy in America, the old if everyone has a PhD, who will be our garbage collectors argument. And I wonder if America has ever been at a point where we have actually faced such a problem. Given how many of our unskilled or manual labor jobs we've either mechanized or outsourced in the last few decades, it's always seemed to me like we have the reverse problem. Too many people who are only qualified for unskilled jobs and not enough to fill the ranks of high tech and research. Most of the highest paying jobs today, like big data analytics, didn't even exist 20 years ago. I really don't think that we're in danger of running out of jobs for people with excellent higher order thinking skills. The present philosophy of schooling positions schools as sort of a giant cotton gin to take in the raw material, i.e. people, and then discard the less quality stuff and keep only what's most useful. And that seems entirely counter to what is at least the stated fundamental mission of public schooling, which is to educate each and every young person in America and equip them with all the skills they need to become a successful citizen in our democracy and successful worker in our economy. It's one of the many contradictions baked into American public education. We ask our schools to both assess and to grade, and the two aren't always the same thing. Sometimes they're even opposites. And my fear is that until we resolve that paradox, we'll be depriving the country and the world of a whole lot of capable people. That's all the time we have for now. Class dismissed, and we'll see you next time. I hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you did, please write us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever it is you found us. Like us on our Facebook page. And if you really enjoy it, please consider visiting our website, www.ed-infinitum.com, and making a donation to keep it running. Otherwise, in the grand tradition of underfunded public schools, we'll be reliant on only what we can make from bake sales. The website is the place to go if you want to suggest a topic or send me an email for any other reason. Our theme music is Happy Schoolmaster by Mind Music ID. Thanks again for listening, and remember, every day brings us opportunities to learn something new. Still with us? Great! Here's a little something extra for you. Today's fun fact about school. A single number 2 pencil of the kind ubiquitous in classrooms across the USA contains enough graphite to draw a single line for 35 miles. That's assuming, of course, that you make no mistakes you'll need to erase and do over. That's all for now. Bye!